to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains.
Expands consciousness.
We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. Whether you are traveling the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to discover more about who we are, why we are here, and where we may be going than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear, because you will be safely traveling with us. You don't need a seatbelt unless we tell you that you need your seatbelt. But you can recline your chair, look out the window, as we're ready to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and you can be a part of the program anytime you like tonight by dialing 888-429-5471. Or you can go to xsquaredradio.com and you can click on, if you have an Android phone, you can click on the X Squared Radio app. It will load to your phone. And anytime you'd like to listen to X Squared Radio live or to BBS Radio Channel 2, which is where we exist, you just click on that app and boom, you're in. The Apple version is on the way. I have a little trouble with my Apple certificate, but I'm working my way through it. Pay close attention tonight. We're going to cover some pretty amazing news. Before we get started, I wanted to let you know about what I want you to do with your income tax refund check. I know you may have plans for it, but these are my plans for it. I want you to join me at Maya 2012 down at Chichen Itza. I think it's a place you'll really enjoy. December 13th through 22nd, I promise to have you home for Christmas, and you will have tales to tell. You meet us in Houston on the 13th of December. We'll get you to Chichen Itza and back, and you can join me and several other world-class speakers down in Chichen Itza with the Power Places organization, myself, Greg Braden, Maureen St. Germain, others going to be down there. And I think in the same venue, strong rumor has it, that Sting and Carlos Santana will be in the same area. Not at our event, but in the same venue. So it could be a pretty amazing experience. We'll let you know more as we get something definitive on that. But the rumor's definitely out there. To be part of it, all you have to do is go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the orange banner on the right-hand side that says Maya 2012, get your deposits in now. Now, we've had several hundred of you click on that banner. You need to reserve your space because the hotels, the venue, this event will sell out. So we want you to be part of it. In case you don't have a passport or you don't want to travel internationally around that time of year, you want to be home earlier than that, that's not a problem. Because you can join me in October in southern Indiana at a very, very nice resort for the Pythagoras Conference. 50 world-class speakers. We're going to be speaking on all kinds of subjects. Many international speakers and royalty going to be there. Princess and so on. And you can join us there. That's within an eight-hour drive of 73% of the population of the U.S. And definitely within driving distance of everywhere. So that's a place you don't have to buy a plane ticket. I'll tell you how rare this is. We never have conferences of this scope and quality in the Midwest. This is your chance. It's super affordable because if you click on the blue Pythagoras Conference banner at X Squared Radio, you will get $100 off. That is amazing. Get a coupon for a discount, and you get a great conference, and you don't have to fly. You don't have to leave the country. So that's what I want you to do with your funds. Now, the solar wind tonight is 379 kilometers per second. That's not too fast. That's a breeze. And the proton count is down to 2.8 protons per cubic centimeter. I remember a couple of weeks ago it was up to 16. That's the highest I've ever seen it. And no coincidence, or maybe it was a coincidence. We had severe weather this week in Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio. And our condolences out to those who lost loved ones or had injuries or damage for which they were not insured. We know that this area is going to have a lot of insurance money poured into it in the next few months. So that part is good. But the terror and the fear of severe weather is certainly bad. The anomaly is that it's been about 24 years since we had this kind of bad weather, except for 2010. In 2010 and 2012, we have already shattered all severe weather records for the Midwest. These storms tend to follow a pattern. They come up from the Gulf. They hit the cold air somewhere around southern Kentucky. By the time they get up into Indiana and Ohio, they're spawning about a dozen tornadoes an hour. So it's 300 or 400 tornadoes in a 48-hour period. This is the kind of weather that we fear when we get toward this 2012 anomaly. Is it, geomagnetic storms caused by the sun? We've certainly had a slew of them lately. Is it galactic radiation or gravity that's coming in? Quite possibly, because all of these things affect the jet stream. Right now, there are 4 sunspot clusters on the sun, but 1429 is so large that it is visible with the naked eye. It does pose a threat for M-class flares. M-class flares are the second most severe type of flares because of their frequency range and power. And in a couple days, it'll be pointed straight at Earth. So be aware and stay tuned. We'll keep you alert on anything. Just log on to or just click on to X Squared Radio and we'll have any kind of announcements on there for you. Another planet, almost as bright and more beautifully colored that can be found, is rising in the east right now. No, it's not Planet X. It's Mars. Mars is putting on a show of its own, opposite of Venus and Jupiter, which if you've been out the last couple of weeks and noticed the fingernail moon beginning to wax right next to it, Venus and Jupiter, just spectacular in the night sky early in the evening. Well, now Mars is right there with it. The red planet is at its closest to Earth for all of 2012, tomorrow. So you might want to go out and get a look at it tonight if you've got clear skies, or tomorrow night. It appears at sunset and soars overhead at midnight, an easy target for the naked eye and backyard telescopes alike. And it doesn't take much of a scope at this point. It's only about 43 million miles away. Mars has a retrograde orbit, so it appears to go one way and then the other across the sky. And that's just because of our orientation to its orbit. Some question whether aliens are about to land, with one woman tweeting, it's a UFO invasion. A ball of fire flew past my window. Others called the police. The most likely explanation, though, was an unusually bright shooting star or meteor. I saw the video of this, Earth Explorers, and this thing was moving very slowly across the sky. It wasn't like a shooting star. I have seen these balls of fire before, and frankly, I've been down close to the Gulf of Mexico driving along, minding my own business, eating cookies and drinking milk, totally black sky above, and a huge ball of fire goes sailing overhead and down over the trees. And I got to be honest, I gripped the wheel. I thought it was going to hit. I thought I was going to see a huge flash. Of course, I didn't, because it was probably 80 miles above the Earth. But other people called the police. The most likely explanation, though, was an unusually bright shooting star meteor. Thousands of people spotted the chunk, or possibly chunks, of roughly baseball-sized space rock burning up while coming to the Earth's atmosphere at an altitude of 60 or 70 miles or so. about 10 p.m. last night. As witnesses took to the internet to report their sightings, Tom Constantine, a self-employed businessman, asked Twitter users, "Did anyone see a shooting star, ball of fire over Knutsford?" David Constantinou of Glasgow tweeted, "Seen a huge meteorite heading south. Huge white tail, flashed green and red. Amazing sight. Made the hairs of my neck stand up." With worried people calling the police, a Greater Manchester police officer jokingly tweeted, "Sounds like we are being invaded by Martians. Several sightings of bright orange light over Salford." Police in southwest Scotland, meanwhile, issued the message, "The large ball of fire in the sky is actually a low-level meteor shower." The Met Office received dozens of calls within an hour of the light first appearing and tweeted, "Hi all, for anyone seeing something in the night sky, we believe it was a meteorite." As they clicked off, one probably said, "Yeah, we're not really sure about that, but we want them to believe it was a meteorite, okay? It probably landed somewhere in France. No big deal." A spokesman for Strathclyde Police said the force had been inundated with calls about a bright object in the sky across the west of Scotland. A Durham police spokeswoman said a number of calls came in around 9:45 p.m. from concerned members of public who had seen a bright light or a fire in the sky and believed it might have been incidents involving aircraft. She said it's been confirmed with air traffic control that there are no incidents of aircraft in difficult and nothing registered on radar. The sightings are believed to be either an asteroid burning out or similar, which has been restricted to the upper atmosphere only. Grampian police said reports of people seeing a flare or bright object with a tail were received from across the region. And Dumfries and Galloway Constabulary said numerous calls were made about a large ball of fire in the sky. This is all in the UK, folks. So the Kielder Observatory had also reported the sighting of a huge fireball traveling north to south over Northumberland at 9:41 p.m. The observatory posted on Twitter, "Of 30 years observing the sky, fire. This is the best fireball I've ever seen, period." Pretty cool stuff. Just wanted you to know that people are looking up people with and without telescopes. One such individual, a couple of years ago, actually 3 years ago, discovered this. And this story just came in. Hang on a moment while I take a sip of grapefruit juice. Delicious organic grapefruit juice. Perfect. All right. An asteroid is headed for Earth. I know. You've heard it before. I have too. But this is different, because it has ramifications and overtones from something we had last year. But I want you to listen closely. To avert a possible catastrophe, this time set for February 2013, scientists suggest confronting asteroid 2012 DA14 with either paint or big guns. The stickler is that time has long run out to build a spaceship to carry out the operation. Now just let that sink in just for a moment. Time has long run out to build a spaceship to carry out the operation. Now you might have missed a detail or two of this, but that's okay. I have you in mind. I'm going to give you some pointers here in just a moment. NASA's data shows the 60-meter asteroid spotted by Spanish stargazers in February will whistle by Earth in 11 months. Its trajectory will bring it within a hair's breadth of our planet, raising fears of a possible collision. Now, the interesting thing is that this was not done by government telescopes, or it would have said so. These were Spanish stargazers, probably using telescopes that were set in what we call a geo-tracking mode. That is to say, they have a motorized drive on the telescope, And what they do each evening is they turn the telescope on. It locks into a specific heavenly body, something that doesn't move, at least relative to space. The Earth, of course, is rotating on its axis. But you can set the telescopes up so that they move the scope at exactly, I mean precisely, the rate at which Earth is revolving. And so it appears in the scope as though everything is standing still, and well, it should. Unless it's moving. And what these scopes do is they're hooked to computers. I mean, they're nice to look through with your eye, but you can't train your eye on every dot of light that's out there. But a computer can, because mounted to the telescope is a CCD cooled camera. Because, as you know, thermal variations can cause noise in cameras, especially if they're taking time-elapsed photography. And with respect to digital technology, it works a little bit different than film. With film, you just kind of open the shutter and you let all the light come in and have a chemical reaction with the chemicals that are in the emulsion of the film. And then you close the shutter. Then you go into a dark room and you develop the film and you see what you can see. With digital technology, it's a little bit different. What happens is you get an accumulation of light as digital data. And the data is then coordinated on a map or a grid inside the software. Every single point of light on there is precisely located, unless it's moving. Each night, perhaps 200 or 300 different samples are taken, layered over each other. Over time, say a week or a month, you can see different points of light moving. Now, the lights that you should see moving are satellites and planets. The things that are not supposed to move are the points of light. They are comets and asteroids, and that's probably how this asteroid was spotted. But this is all amateur, and as I have said many times for years on this program, most of the comets and asteroids that have been discovered in the last 50 years have been discovered by amateurs. Some of them are discovered by the government scopes, especially the one in Hawaii. But remember, these government scopes operate off of grants and off of donations by people, you know, from SETI and different universities and governments and philanthropists. They are contracted to look at certain swaths of space each night. They only have a limited amount of time. They're not looking for NEOs. They're not looking for near-Earth objects. That is left to amateurs, and this one was spotted by a Spanish stargazer last month. We have 11 months to get ready for this. Now, you'd think, gee, that's a short amount of time. How can we possibly get ready? Listen up. The asteroid, known as DA14, will pass by our planet in February 2013 at a distance of under 27,000 kilometers. Quick calculation, that's about 16,700 miles, plus or minus. This is closer than many of the geosynchronous satellites around Earth. They're 23,500 miles out. There is a possibility that the asteroid will collide with Earth. But further calculation is required to estimate the potential threat and work out how to avert possible disaster. How big is the disaster? I want to talk about that too. This is a NASA expert, Dr. David Dunham, talking to students at Russia's University of Electronics and Mathematics. The Earth's gravitational field will alter the asteroid's path significantly. Further, scrupulous calculation is required to estimate the threat of collision, said Dr. Dunham, as transcribed by Russia's Izvestia. The asteroid may break into dozens of small pieces, or several large lumps may split from it and burn up in the atmosphere. The type of the asteroid and its mineral structure can be determined by spectral analysis. That hasn't been done yet. This will help predict its behavior in the atmosphere and what should be done to prevent the potential threat, said Dr. Dunham. He is exactly right. If the asteroid is made up mostly of rock, that would be like stone, limestone, basalt, something like that from a a Mars rock or a moon rock or a asteroid, typical asteroid. We don't have much to worry about. It's super cold right now, probably close to absolute zero, especially if it's got any lightness to it at all, because it won't absorb any infrared energy from the sun. It's a pretty small target, doesn't have a lot of surface area. Half of it is dark all the time, so it's going to be pretty darn cold. When it starts entering the atmosphere, it will heat up in a hurry. Like within a few minutes, it'll reach several thousand degrees. This will probably cause it to explode if it's rock. If it's not rock, if it turns out to be iron or nickel or some solid metal, it won't explode. It may melt. It may get hot on one side, but it's going to stay in one piece or several large pieces. In the event of a collision, scientists have calculated that the energy released would equate to the destructive power of a nuclear bomb. How big? We don't know. I would say it depends on the angle of attack, whether it is a glancing blow, like it's going to do what this fireball did across these across the UK yesterday or last night, or whether it's a more perpendicular angle, that is to say a straight shot, you know, aimed, you know, right at Main Street. With the asteroid zooming that low, it will be too late to do anything with it besides try to predict its final destination and the consequences of impact. Obviously, if we do the statistics, roughly 65-70% of the Earth is covered with water, and so we have less than a 50% chance that it will even land on land. And, of course, 80-90% of the population of every single continent is within 20 miles of its coast. So the odds are that it's going to land in a flyover country. If it does land on land, and, you know, what's the worst that can happen? About what happened with the storms over the last few days. A spaceship is needed, experts agree. It could shoot down the rock or just crash into it, either breaking the asteroid into debris or throwing it off its course. We could also paint it, says NASA expert David Dunham. Paint would affect the asteroid's ability to reflect sunlight, changing its temperature and altering its spin. In other words, we could heat up the asteroid by painting it a color that would absorb a lot of infrared radiation. The asteroid would stalk off its course, but it could also make the boulder even more dangerous when it comes back in 2056. Alexander Devakin, the head of the observatory in Russia's Pulkovo, told Izvestia. So is a spaceship possible? Well, whatever the mission, building a spaceship to deal with 2012 DA14 will take 2 years at least. The asteroid has proven a bitter discovery. It has been circling in orbit for 3 years already. Now, wait a minute. I thought we just said that a Spanish stargazer discovered this in February. Well, if a Spanish stargazer discovered this in February, how do we know that it's been circling for 3 years already? And if it's been circling for 3 years already, why does it have the nomenclature 2012 DA14? Why doesn't it have the nomenclature 2009 DA14? You see, there are some discrepancies in this story, which I thought would be interesting, and it's why I'm talking about it tonight. It has already crossed Earth's path several times, says space analyst Sergei Naronkov from the Russian Academy of Sciences. It seems that spotting danger from outer space is still the area where mere chance reigns, while asteroid defense systems exist only in drafts. The question I have is why? Last year, we had a very, you know, famous encounter with a comet. You remember that, Elenin. Oh, boy, the rumors flew all about that. We had several programs on it. We talked about it. And I told people, this is going to, even though it's got a very weird structure, it's come out of a place we're not really acquainted with comets from coming from. As soon as it gets within the sun's effects, it's going to boil off, break into pieces, and evaporate. And that's exactly what it did. And the closest it got to Earth was about 200,000 miles. However, it was really the subject of a lot of excitement. Now, and it's not the first one. We've had several encounters like this, not just with asteroids, not just with comets, but also asteroids. So my question is, why are we still 2 years away from having an anti-asteroid, anti-comet space response team? We had a global awareness for a comet that got no closer than 200,000 miles, and it did not alert us to have a short development, a short deployment force ready to defend Earth from a possible collision of something this size. We can spend $6 trillion annually on a global basis to kill each other, but we cannot marshal a ready force to get some kind of defense against this? The Russian analyst said it. It's just a matter of chance. It's just a matter of statistics. It is going to happen. So why are we not ready? Still, the prospects of meeting 2012 DA-14 are not all doom and gloom. The asteroid may split into pieces entering the atmosphere. In this case, most parts of it will never reach the planet's surface, remarks Dunham. Most of them. But if the entire asteroid is to crash into the planet, the impact will be as hard as in the Tunguska blast, which in 1908 knocked down trees over a total area of 830 square miles in Siberia. You're familiar with this. It's almost the size of Luxembourg, the country. In today's case, the destruction of the asteroid is yet to be determined. So it's just an interesting thing to think about. By the way, those of you that are just joining us, I know most of you log on somewhere right at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific. We have a new app at X Squared Radio. If you go right to xsquaredradio.com, right on the front, at the top, you'll see the X Squared Radio logo. If you click on that, this is an Android app. So if you have Android phones, I would appreciate you clicking on that app. You may have to click on the Winamp logo once you get in there, but it should stream this program to your cell phone with one click. So we just wanted to test it out. I wrote it last week. It's my first, so be gentle. And the iPhone app is on the way. Now, there are some apps available at BBS Radio that you can access by going to the web with your phone, and you can click on these and you'll be able to access directly. But I don't know if it will actually, you know, give you an app in your app store. This is an app that you can actually go on your computer with a logo, and in the future, anytime, night or day, 24 hours a day, you can click that and boom, you're into BBS Radio Channel 2. We hope that you do it, you know, from 5 to 8 Pacific time on Sunday evenings, because that's when X Squared Radio is on. But we are always in support of BBS Radio. It is absolutely without doubt documented as the number one webcast radio network on the web, and X Squared Radio is the number one program on that network. So you do the math. We're trying to stay out on the leading edge for you, trying to bring you some very leading edge, cutting edge stories and give you my perspective on them. We're also going to have Rico Paganini back on the program. As you know, he's a publisher, and he has done a lot of research on Giza and some of the ancient technologies. He's got a new book out called The Day Legacy. This is DEI, Day Legacy. And in this phenomenally excellent, high-quality book, it is the nicest hardbound book I've ever seen on any subject. The pages are immaculate. The paper is high quality. Color photographs all the way through, hardbound. This is a $100 to $120 book, not nearly that expensive to buy. It's called Day Legacy, Rico Paganini. We're going to have him on the program this month to talk about it, possibly next week. And in this book, he compares all of the calendars of the earth. And so interesting that the Maya calendar is the only non-religious calendar on the earth. It is based purely on mathematics. But they were primitive. Everybody knows that. Anyway, Rico Paganini, pay close attention. Next week we may have him on. I'm speaking with his publicist this week. So do you think we're safe? I mean, really, we've done so much lately. You know, the Patriot Act. We have Homeland Security. We got all this stuff going on, and I just want to know, do you feel safe? 888-429-5471. Are you being watched enough? Eh? Things being taken care of? It's kind of interesting because, you know, most of the people that I know that have had some kind of altercation, assault, car broke into, whatever, the first question I ask is, hey, what did the surveillance cameras show? Yeah, absolutely. You know, there is an increasing concern that the Department of Homeland Security will fail to meet an upcoming congressional mandate to have 100% monitoring of all cargo inbound into the United States, according to a report. As you know, when Homeland Security was first enacted as a brand new department, one of the first things that came up with is, gee, you know, we get hundreds of thousands of shipping containers in from all over the world. You know, these container ships come in, and if you ever watched it, it's just fascinating. These giant, like, barge-like ships come in, and they're stacked, you know, 10, 20 high with shipping containers, and that's just on the deck. There are also containers below decks, and they're just stacked up there, you know. They're just kind of riding up there, all interlocked with each other. But when they arrive, they pull into the dock. They have a gantry-style crane that goes over the ship, and it latches onto these shipping containers, and it is so fast. These guys can grab these, you know, ship containers with, you know, 20,000, 30,000 pounds in them and whip them around like they're Lego blocks. Unbelievable. Unfortunately, you know, they're all made of steel. And it's heavy gauge steel. I mean, you can go up to one of these shipping containers. You can smack it with the biggest sledgehammer you can pick up. And you better be wearing some hearing protection because it'll make a loud bang. But it won't hurt the shipping container. These things are built to take a licking, folks. They're designed to handle, you know, the ravages of the sea. They put them on rail. They put them on trucks. They haul them all over the world, fill them with all kinds of crap. Fill them with anything from tennis shoes to auto parts to, you know, you name it. And they last for years and years and years. I know a shipping container company, a Korean company that makes the containers. It's a big business, folks. But all those shipping containers come into this country unchecked. They are sealed in Shanghai or, you know, in one of the warm water ports from Russia or in Europe or in South America, and they get on the boat and they're not unlocked until they get to their point of destination. I mean, they clear customs based on the manifest. They're not opened. They're just weighed, and you know, you could say, oh yeah, it's copies of artifacts, and it could be anything. But that cargo is supposed to be checked, or at least that was the promise. The Government Accounting Office, the investigative arm of Congress, said that the Department of Homeland Security is nowhere close to complying with the requirement that by July, all U.S. bound cargo must be routinely scanned for nuclear and radiological materials and other components to make weapons of mass destruction. According to Judicial Watch, the Department of Homeland Security has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on questionable systems that couldn't do the scanning. Well, I have an issue with them calling them questionable systems. Most of this technology has existed for airports, for small things like luggage and you know, small scanning things where you can put a pallet in it or something like that. But a shipping container, as I just told you, is a sealed steel box that is very difficult to look through. If you put something in there that's hermetically sealed, packed in coffee and lined with lead, you're not going to pick up any kind of radiological indication from it. It's going to be, you know, quiet, atomically quiet. You're not going to be able to detect anything. And how, why would they call it questionable systems that couldn't do the scanning? Do you think they actually tested it? Do you think they actually put a lump of uranium or plutonium in one of these things and scanned it and said, hey, you're not doing the job here. You can't pick this up. It's quite possible that that's exactly what they did. But you have to understand, all this technology is new. It's never been done before. And so you will have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on systems that may not work. But it doesn't have to work. It only has to make the people who would ship this stuff believe that it will work. Trust me, I have traveled all over the Middle East and China, and I've run my bags through metal scanners in a dozen different countries. None of them work. Nobody's even standing there watching the screen. It's just a conveyor that goes through an empty shell. But the intimidation of that it could work is enough. You have guys standing there wearing weapons, and you're walking up to an airport, and you're going to smuggle something onto an airplane, and you're going to get caught, and they're going to take you in the back, and they're going to shoot you in the head. There's no due process of law in a lot of these countries. I've had my stuff rifled through, and they take all the AA batteries. That's just routine. You have to hide them in your socks or something, you know, to get them through, because they'll just take them. Batteries are a premium over there. They just are. But the scanners, they don't work. They're just there for an intimidation factor. They're there to make the FAA feel comfortable. That's all. So the idea that this is questionable technology is a big assumption. In one case, DHS spent $200 million on 1,400 radiation portal monitors, but had to stop using them since they didn't do the job. How do they know? How do they know? You have to calibrate these things when you put them in place. You've got to put some cesium source in it, and it's got to pick it up. It has to be able to go ding, 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 ding. Hey, there's a cesium nickel in here. You're telling me that they put 1,400 radiological portal monitors in, and none of them were calibrated? None of them were functioned? That just can't be. I've built them myself. I built a radio spectrometer that would detect radon coming up through the ground, and it would identify the species, by the way, as well as sodium-40 and thorium and all kinds of other species. And I used to calibrate it with a cesium nickel. And it was perfectly accurate and extremely sensitive. And it cost me $20,000 to build. You cannot tell me that this didn't work. I know that it would work. 10 years ago, the 9/11 Commission made a recommendation for 100% compliance by July of 2012. The requirement was incorporated into the 9/11 Commission Act of 2007. Within the DHS, Customs and Border Protection implements container security. Uncertainty persists over how DHS and CBP will fulfill the mandate for 100% scanning, given the feasibility remains unproven in light of the challenges CBP has faced and implementing a pilot program for 100% scanning, the Governmental Accounting Office said. In attempting to determine whether 100% scanning was feasible, GAO had asked the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, to undertake such a study, but to date, that hasn't happened. What? They asked them to do a study, and to date, that hasn't happened? Are you kidding me? How hard is it to put sodium iodide crystals in something to detect any kind of scintillation in the gamma range? Now, if you're going to detect beta particles, that's quite a bit different. Okay, let me tell you what the difference is, because not many of you out there have degrees in nuclear chemistry. I can help you with this because I do. So the difference is that a gamma scintillation is very high energy and can penetrate loose items like aluminum or glass or something like that, go right through it. And it's easy to detect because it's fairly high energy. When it hits a sodium iodide crystal, it makes a scintillation event, which is picked up by a very sensitive circuit that multiplies it and gives you a count. Not only that, the frequency of that species can be determined from that. That means that you can tell the difference between radon, cesium, plutonium, not plutonium, but uranium. Now, a beta particle is quite a bit different. It is slower moving. It is also large. It can also be blocked by stuff like glass, aluminum, steel, clothing. It doesn't penetrate very easily. You have to ingest it. You have to breathe it into your body. Then when that beta decay occurs, it will cause the death of whatever tissue it happens to strike. That's how chemotherapy works, folks. That's how radiation therapy works. Well, you can't do a beta scan of the inside of a steel container. It ain't going to work. You have to sniff the air inside the container. Actually, that's a pretty good headspace. That thing's been sealed up since it left its port, and odds are that the air inside the container is going to be much more concentrated with those particles than the air outside the container. So you have to get inside the container and you have to sniff the air. This can be done, but for something the size of a shipping container, what you have to do is put this entire thing inside a chamber. Then you have to close the doors to the chamber. And then you have to take the atmospheric pressure of that chamber down a bit, not to a complete vacuum, but just down a few thousand feet in altitude, or should I say up a few thousand feet in altitude, down a few pounds per square inch. This will cause the air inside the container to exhaust, to diffuse outside the cracks of the container, because they're not airtight. When that air diffuses outside the container, it's going to contain a sample of what's inside the container, and that is what you sample. Now, it's way too late to go back to all these shipping containers and have a test port put in. And I'm not so sure that a test port would be a good idea. And here's why. If you went back to all the shipping container companies and said, look, you have to go punch a hole in this thing, and you have to put a standard XYZ AA45 test port in it, standard port. We're going to use it in the ports of all the world. Because if you do that, somebody could go inside that container and they could put a bag over the port on the inside of the container with a special sample, you know, fresh air from the south of France. And then when you plug in your probe to the test port, you take your air sample, you're sampling a bladder or you're sampling a welded box that's been put on the inside of that ship container over the test port. You don't know anything's happened from the outside. You just have the standard port. So it's a bad idea. But you can put these things in a giant box. You can exhaust the air, not all of it, just a little bit of it, enough to get some of the air to come out of that. And it will go ahead and give you a sample of what's inside. I don't think there's any way to stick a bunch of probes inside this thing with a handheld. I don't think there are cracks in the door sufficient to get in there. I know these shipping containers, when you close the door, there's no light. There's no crack, nothing. They're sealed up pretty tight. They're designed to prevent infiltration of, you know, driven rain or something like that, because a lot of these things are food. They're rice. They're flour. They're, you know, milk powder. They're clothing. Fabric, stuff like that, white yarn. You can't have water, seawater, or from a rainstorm or something driving in there on a shipping container. It's got to be sealed up. But they're not absolutely airtight. They are, however, not watertight, but you can't hose them down and get water on the inside of them. That's just the nature of the beast. Some of them have wooden floors in them. The wood is installed on top of the metal. That doesn't have actually a wooden floor. And a lot of them have tie downs and things like that on the inside. You can drive nails into the floor and secure a wooden block or something like that. Well, a lot like a truck's floor would be. Just makes it easy to rebuild them and to slide things in and out of them. So that's how it would have to be done. But can you imagine the energy it would take, the pumps that you would have to run to take the atmospheric pressure inside these boxes down? Remember I told you how fast the gantry cranes unload these giant ships? Well, that would slow down the shipping to a point where it would just not be feasible. You spend billions of dollars building these chambers. This is not feasible. That's what I'm telling you. And this attempt to do 100% scanning, the study hasn't even happened. And I've only scratched the surface with the questions that should be asked. Well, CBP informed GAO, don't you love these acronyms? Government loves them. That it has not conducted such an assessment or identified alternatives and is no longer pursuing efforts to implement 100% scanning, a development that could place the nation's security at serious risk. Out of 9 foreign and domestic ports that were supposed to be involved in the 100% compliance study, any DHS testing was limited to just 1 port. DHS has informed GAO that it will not be able to meet the 9/11 Act's July 2012 deadline for implementing the 100% testing requirement and wants to extend the requirement to include foreign ports for compliance until July 2014. Still feeling safe? Well, there you go. The odds are that if you had nefarious plans or you wanted to import something and say it was something else, it'd be pretty easy to do. Well, that brings us almost up to the top of the hour. I'm going to take 5 more minutes and just talk about this because I'm going to get into the next subject, and it is quite controversial. However, it is very, very leading edge on the headlines. Not only the headlines that you're reading now, but the ones you're going to read in a few days. You're going to hear about it first right here. Our phone number, if you want to be part of the program tonight, and believe me, the subject matter for tonight is very hot. You may not hear about this on the mainstream news for a while, but you need to be informed, so I'm going to give it to you here. Our phone number is 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. We also have a conference call line, which you can get off the website, either mine or at xsquaredradio.com or at bbsradio.com. Several of you have sent me Facebook messages and Twitter messages that you would like my email address. It's simple, bagnew@x2-radio.com. The contact information is right there on the website. And also, I am accepting booking events. So if you want to book me at your event, and believe me, it's affordable because it's free. The only thing I ask is travel arrangements, someplace to stay. It doesn't have to be a hotel. It could be a spare room. And the opportunity to sell books and DVDs. That's it. I mean, it could not be easier than that. So go there. I have a couple of great lectures that I give, and you put anywhere from 10 to 10,000 people together, and I will gladly come to your location and speak. I don't care where it is. I don't care what the speaking conditions are. I've spoken in libraries, parking lots, certainly auditoriums, universities, classrooms, many, many, many classrooms. So don't be afraid. It's easy to do. Just go to xsquaredradio.com. Click on the link that says Book Dr. Brooks Agnew, and you can fill out the information. It's easy. Now, that being said, I have had lots and lots and lots of requests for a workshop. Many of you have read the book. Many thousands of you have read the book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. And you've called me and written me with questions, and I've done my best to answer them, although it is not quite as good as hands-on. I agree with that. I've been to the classes with the masters myself. I'm not saying I am a master, but I am a novice, and I would be happy to give you introductory courses to get you to the point where you're ready to go on to mastery. And I could do it very inexpensively if you can come to Charlotte. So I have a venue that is a good venue. Charlotte is a wonderful city. It's very inexpensive to come to. And we can do all this in about a day and a half. You can come on a Friday. We'll have dinner. We'll work all day Saturday and be done Saturday evening. Or if you want to, we can continue to Sunday morning, and then you can go on your merry way. I think I'm going to just do this in one long day because I can get through the entire thing, give you all the meditation training, a 55-page workbook and everything, and I can do this for less than $100. I'm serious. So if anywhere from 5 to 50 of you want to come, I've got a venue. It's a good venue, and I can take you in. If you're interested in doing that, let me know by email or Twitter me at Brooks Agnew. Or you can Facebook me at X2-Radio, or I think it's Brooks Agnew, or you can write me at Skype at X2-Radio, or you can write me at bagnew at X2-Radio.com. I will post the workshop dates on the website. Charlotte is fairly accessible to anybody on the Eastern Seaboard. It is an extremely cheap airport to fly into, and it's a wonderful time to come. As you know, the Democratic Convention is going to be here later on this year. So lots and lots and lots of accommodations have been made for you to come here. And I would be very, very willing to meet you, give you more information, sign your books if you haven't already got them signed, and provide you a full DVD set as well as a 55-page workbook for less than $100. So come on, it's a great deal. We need you. It's very, very important that we get you trained. Already we are seeing the things that I mentioned in the book. As you know, it was written in the year 2015 about the collapse of the Office of the Presidency, the formation of the Presidential Council. You're already seeing it in the works. It's unfolding exactly as it was in the history books from the year 2015. So we need you. We need you. We need a different future than the one that unfolded. So we need to get you trained. I'm just trying to cover the basic costs of doing that. Not trying for any self-aggrandizement at all, but I'm willing to serve. So if you're willing to participate, I will do that. Let's do this because we're right at the top of the hour. We are about, well, I can do a couple more minutes. I want to make this invitation to you because I think that it's important. The same basic questions that I have are about, okay, I've read the book. I know about the 8 iterations. When do I start the 8 iterations? What do I apply my energy to? How do I do my dreaming? I really think that you need this 3-hour lecture. We'll break it up into 2 parts, and there's a lot of hands-on with it. I know that you will enjoy it, so I want to participate with you. So let me know. I'll put the dates on the website, and you can sign up. It'll be super easy. It's very inexpensive, and it's affordable. And I promise you'll come away with a good feeling, and you'll have a wonderful time here in Charlotte. So, you know, just participate a little bit. I know that you'll enjoy it. I'll enjoy meeting with you. As well. Let's do a little civil twilight, letters from the sky, and we'll be back right after this. Don't go away. I'm Brooks Agnew. This is X Squared Radio.
One of these days the mountains
back for you. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio Hour 2, March 4, 2012, coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachians. I just want you to know how much I appreciate you being part of the program. We try to bring these programs to you every Sunday. It takes me about a week to prepare for a three-hour radio broadcast. Your patronage, your loyalty here has been a big, big help for me. And I love your emails, so don't forget to write me. I promise I will write every one of you back. I always do. And I'm pretty quick about it, so don't be afraid to write. If you want to be part of the program, it's easy. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Get a hold of the studio. We'll get you in here and get your question asked. Don't forget about the app, the Android app at xsquaredradio.com. Quick, easy, one-click way of getting into the program. And the iPhone, iPad Touch or iPhone Touch, iPod Touch app is on its way. All the backgrounds are done. I'm working on the code. I'm an amateur at this, so be patient with me, and we'll get it out to you. So the big question in the news now is it time to leave Afghanistan? That, for some, would be a political question. But for those of us who are good at doing this kind of research, we know that it is a historical one. The U.S. Army's Afghan Quran burning and the violent Islamic reaction that followed has finally given media prominence to one simple question. Why are we still there? The U.S. government has given all kinds of reasons why we can't leave now. And to be honest, they sound remarkably similar to all the reasons the U.S. said it couldn't leave Vietnam for years. Many of you don't remember that. I joined the Air Force in 1972, late 1972, went active in 73. And it was right at the end of the Vietnam War, so there was a massive push to get out at that point. It became politically exasperating. Lots of bad stories and reports that we were making no progress at all, when in actuality we probably did and were. We're doing business with Vietnam today. Very good business, I might add, furniture and textiles and electronics, because of the work we did during that time. So maybe it's not all for naught. Just exchange the word Islamic and communist in the U.S. official announcements from both wars, and you'll see exactly what I mean. Any of these standard reasons for soldiering on pale against the reasons for leaving now. Number one, we killed bin Laden. And I've already talked about that lots of times, whether we did or whether we didn't, whether he was already dead, and this was just kind of the political end to it. It's the number one reason we went to that part of the world, and now it's done, you know. For good measure, we've eliminated most of his high-level sidekicks as well. So the Al-Qaeda is no more. It's gone. It's finished. There is no more Al-Qaeda. The large U.S. Army presence is no longer needed in Afghanistan. Afghanistan has been a historical quagmire for foreign armies. Even Alexander the Great couldn't conquer Afghanistan. Also, the U.S. Army may have worn out its welcome. Yeah, we're doing some good there, but we are seen as occupiers, and the time is, you know, finished. We're trying to nation build in Afghanistan, and it will never work. Even our hand signals, our body smell, everything is wrong. When we're backing the most hated man in Afghanistan, I mean, come on. Hamid Karzai is corrupt. He represents corruption. I'm going to tell you why in just a little bit. These are just the headlines. Our Afghan allies are literally killing us, and we've had that happen just a little bit here in the last couple days. And the money spent on the Afghan war is needed, desperately needed, in other areas. All of these headlines, and I'd love to go into them all, but in this hour, I don't want to waste your time with all of the rhetoric and all of the propaganda, because all of these miss the main point. I asked this question to some friends of mine, just, you know, just as a hypothetical, you know, because we discussed these things throughout the week. Do you think we'll ever defeat the drug cartels in Mexico? Yeah, I see. You agree with me. That's right. The answer is no. Now, let me ask the question, why? Show of hands. Oh, yes, that's exactly right. Because drugs, yes, yeah, that's right. Drug money from the users to the dealers to the cartels to the growers and all the way down to the field worker, local schools, hospitals, municipal projects, it is an entire economy. And it's never going to end. It doesn't matter if we burn the fields. It doesn't matter if we kill the drug dealers. It doesn't matter if we interrupt the cash flow. It doesn't matter because it will continue because it will. And don't forget the politicians on both sides of the border. As long as the users intend to get high, and believe me, none of us see an end to that kind of behavior. If anything, it's going up. Then the cartels will exist. It's as simple as that. You know, is the solution legalization? No. Even though I am a libertarian and I believe that the government really has no place in telling you what you can do with your body, I don't think legalization is the answer. We've tried that. No, not recently, but I mean, I'm going to give you some history here so you can have it. Istanbul, for instance, tried that. Their gross national product fell by 25% in a few years. Now, it's the death penalty for dealing drugs. Guess what? That's right. The gross domestic product went back up. People didn't quit using the drugs. There's no hope of that. The users couldn't care less what the national state is. They will use drugs if it was fertilized with human blood. Well, yeah, that's right. I guess it is fertilized with human blood. So there you go. Okay, they're not going to quit. The press has tried to make you believe that this war in Afghanistan is about terror. Yes, we were trying to chase down bin Laden. Yes, we were trying to end al-Qaeda. We were trying to educate women. We were trying to save the country from the dust and despondency that terrorists were dealing to its own people. Or that it's about radical Islam, or that it's about oil. That is nonsense. All of it is Feldergarb. There is no oil in Afghanistan. There are all kinds of religions in Afghanistan. There is Christianity, several different sects, thousands and thousands and thousands of them in Afghanistan. A war on terror is as useless as a war on anger or jealousy or envy. You kill terrorists and levy sanctions against them, and you are supposed to garner love and compassion as a result. Get a brain, people. There is no al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. There is only the Taliban. Ah, yes, the Taliban. The Taliban is a nationally endorsed drug cartel. Sound familiar? They produce 90% of the world's heroin. Not cocaine, not marijuana, heroin, opium. It is the sole source of real capital in Afghanistan, and it has been grown there for more than 1,000 years. The war in Afghanistan is about drug money. Nothing more, nothing less. U.S. troops control the ground where the U.S. troops are. 100 yards away, they don't. The Taliban controls Afghanistan the same now as it has since before the Russians invaded many decades ago. Why did they invade? Heroin. Why did we invade? Heroin. There is more heroin produced in Afghanistan now than ever. We tried to tell ourselves that educating the people would free them. It did. It helped. But the Taliban, like the Chinese in North Vietnam, marched through the towns and killed the people who could read and put the rest back to work in the fields. They are cowards who will never obey the rules of war because they are not warriors. They are criminals and have operated with one motivation for many millennia. They seek to make the world their addicts. They can put all the religious spin on it they want. They can call it Islam. They can call it death to the infidel. But it is about cash. Wars have been fought for hundreds and hundreds of years to try to stop this from happening. A little bit of history. Maybe you remember this from school. Maybe they didn't even cover it. The Opium Wars, also known as the Anglo-Chinese Wars, divided into the First Opium War from 1839 to 1842 and the Second Opium War from 1856 to 1860, were the climax of disputes over trade and diplomatic relationships between China under the Qing Dynasty and the British Empire. What I am about to tell you is a carbon copy, almost a carbon copy of what we are seeing now. It has been something that has been perpetrated not from the drug-growing companies or countries to the buyers. Oh, no, 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 no. Quite the opposite, my friends. After the inauguration of the Canton system in 1756, which restricted trade to one port and did not allow foreign entrance to China, the British East India Company faced a trade imbalance in favor of China and invested heavily in opium production to redress the balance. You remember the statement, the sun never sets on the British Empire? The British had business, expensive business, all over the world. British and United States merchants brought opium from the British East India Company's factories in Patna and Benares in the Bengal Presidency of British India to the coast of China, where they sold it to Chinese smugglers who distributed the drug in defiance of Chinese laws, aware both of the drain of silver, that's what they used to pay for the drugs, and the growing numbers of addicts, the Daoguang Emperor demanded action. Officials at the court who advocated legalization of trade in order to tax it were defeated by those who advocated suppression. Sound familiar? Let's legalize drugs, then we can tax them, then we can control them. Sounds familiar. In 1838, the emperor sent Lin Zexu to Guangzhou, where he quickly arrested Chinese opium dealers and summarily demanded that foreign firms turn over their stocks. When they refused, of course they would have, Lin stopped trade altogether and placed the foreign residents under virtual siege, eventually forcing the merchants to surrender their opium to be destroyed. In response, now that would be a good idea for us to do, we seize all the property and lay siege to the drug dealers and order them to bring their drugs to be destroyed. We haven't done that yet. In response, the British government sent expeditionary forces from India, which ravaged the Chinese coast and dictated the terms of settlement. The Treaty of Nanking not only opened the way for further opium trade, but ceded territory, including Hong Kong, which only recently was given back to China. It ceded it because of the opium trade. It unilaterally fixed Chinese tariffs at a low rate, granted extraterritorial rights to foreigners in China, which were not offered to Chinese abroad, a most favored nation clause, as well as diplomatic representation. when the court still refused to accept foreign ambassadors and obstructed the trade clauses of the treaties, disputes over the treatment of British merchants in Chinese ports and on the seas led to the Second Opium War and the Treaty of Tianjin. These treaties, soon followed by similar arrangements with the United States and France, later became known as the Unequal Treaties, and the Opium Wars was the start of China's century of humiliation. Now, that's from our point of view. If you look at China's history and you go into that and read about it, and I have, the Chinese were really not humiliated. Most of the people in the countryside never even knew anything happened. They weren't addicted to opium. It wasn't nothing humiliating about it. But we call it China's century of humiliation. Following the Battle of Plassey in 1757, in which Britain annexed Bengal to its empire, the British East India Company pursued a monopoly on production and export of Indian opium. Monopoly began in earnest in 1773, and the British Governor General of Bengal abolished the opium syndicate at Patna. For the next 50 years, opium trade would be the key to the East India Company's hold on the subcontinent. Evidently, keeping the people with whom you are trading stoned, unproductive, because that's what opium does to you. You smoke it, or you put it into injections, which they didn't really have back then, but they used to chew it, and they used to smoke it, and they used to snort it, and they would stay stoned all the time. And when you're high, you're not too productive. That's why the country really doesn't like it. You know, I'll cover that in the last hour. I'm going to cover the National Department, or the Federal Department of Education. And I want to cover this because it has become a huge part of our society, not only part of it in notoriety, but also celebrities. It has become part of our culture, and it really only has become part of our culture in a prominent way in the last 40 years. Before that, we kind of got away from that habit, at least in the public eye. It was something that was done in the back room. Well, considering that importation of opium into China had been virtually banned by Chinese law, the East India Company established an elaborate trading scheme, partially relying on legal markets and partially leveraging illicit ones. Sound familiar? British merchants carrying no opium would buy tea in Canton on credit, and would balance their debts by selling opium at auction in Calcutta. From there, the opium would reach the Chinese coast, hidden aboard British ships, then smuggled into China by native merchants, not British. In 1797, the company further tightened its grip on the opium trade by enforcing direct trade between opium farmers and the British, cutting out the middleman and ending the role of Bengali purchasing agents. We call this, in these days, smuggling. British exports of opium to China grew. Now, this is going to stagger you. Hang on a second. I'm going to take a drink of my wonderful ice-cold grapefruit juice because this staggers me too. It's going to blow your mind. I didn't really mean that. There are other ways to blow your mind. This is going to astonish you. British exports of opium to China grew from an estimated 15 tons in 1730 to 75 tons in 1773. 75 tons, folks. That's a lot. That's 150,000 pounds of opium. Do you know how far a pound of opium goes? Yeah. A pound. 16 times 35. Yeah, you got it. 570 ounces of opium per pound. do the math. The product was delivered in over 2,000 chests, each containing 140 pounds of opium. Meanwhile, negotiations with the Qinglong Emperor to ease the trading ban carried on, coming to a head in 1793 under Earl George McCartney, which these days we would call this the Secretary of Drug Trafficking. Such discussions were unsuccessful. In 1799, a mere 6 years later, the Qing Empire reinstated their ban on opium imports. The empire issued the following decree in 1810. It's hard to believe how long it took for this stuff to occur, but it did. Opium has a harm. Opium is a poison, undermining our good customs and morality. Its use is prohibited by law. Now the commoner, Yang, dares to bring it into the Forbidden City. Indeed, he flouts the law. However, recently the purchasers, eaters, and consumers of opium have become numerous. Deceitful merchants buy and sell it to gain profit. The customs house at the Chu Yung Wen Gate was originally set up to supervise the collection of imports. If we confine our search for opium to the seaports, we fear the search will not be sufficiently thorough. We should also order the general commandant of the police and police censors at the five gates to prohibit opium and to search for it at all gates. If they capture any violators, they should immediately punish them and should destroy the opium at once. As to Kwang Tung and Fujian, the provinces from which opium comes, we order their viceroys, governors, and superintendents of the maritime customs to contain a thorough search for opium and to cut off its supply. They should in no ways consider this order a dead letter and allow opium to be smuggled out. Well, just as it happens in our country, the decree had little effect. The Qing government, seated in Beijing in the north of China, was unable to halt opium smuggling in the southern provinces. A porous Chinese border and rampant local demand only encouraged the all-too-eager East India Company, which had its monopoly on opium trade recognized by the British government, which itself wanted the silver. By the 1820s, China was importing 900 tons of Bengali opium annually. And it gets worse. 900 tons of opium is enough to addict our entire country. A year going into that country. Why didn't it stop? Got any ideas? 888-429-5471. Because it was being paid for in cash. Because the cash was being turned into silver. And the silver was being exported back to Britain. Britain was buying the opium and importing it. And they were making tons of money doing it. And they were doing it to balance trade. So now we have this country, Afghanistan, whose main crop, its main cash crop, is opium. And you think to yourself, what in the world? Why are we involving the military in this? Because it's been done before. The first war took place in 1839 and lasted to 1842. Now keep in mind, folks, this is 50-something years. 60 years after opium started becoming an import smuggling trade for the British. And we could just move the names around. That's not the important thing. Don't get mad at the Brits. Because, in China, there weren't really opium users when they began. They had to develop the market. Remember, they started out with 75 tons a year. I'm sorry, 15 tons. Then they went to 75 tons. Now we're to 900 tons. And it doesn't stop there. They're creating the addicts in the country. Once you're addicted, you have to have the opium. Believe me, the reported withdrawal symptoms are so painful that people have to do the drug just to maintain, to get through the day. In 1834, to accommodate the revocation of the East India Company's monopoly, the British sent Lord William John Napier to Macau. He tried to circumvent the restrictive Canton trade laws, which forbade direct contact with Chinese officials, by attempting to send a letter directly to the Viceroy of Canton. The Viceroy, of course, refused to accept it and closed trade starting on the 2nd of September of that year. Lord Napier had to return to Macau, where he died a few days later. And unable to force the matter, the British agreed to resume trade under the old restrictions. It doesn't really say how he died a few days later, but I would say he died of natural causes when his heart stopped after a blade went through it. Within the Chinese Mandarinate, there was an ongoing debate over legalizing the opium trade itself. They thought, oh, gee, we'll just take the money out of it. We'll make it legal, and that way we can control it. We can get taxes over it. We can monitor it. And once we take all the cash out of it, because it'll be legal, we won't bother to stop the importation. We'll get involved in it. Maybe we can compete against the British and bring the price down. And once you take the price down, then you decriminalize it. And, of course, it will no longer be interesting to the British. However, by the way, does that sound really familiar? Yes, it does. Just go to California. You'll see. You'll see what's going on. Half that state is stoned. If you take a survey of high school students in California, 70%, not 7%, not 10, 70% of the students have used marijuana on a semi-regular basis. And now you wonder why the state is getting ready to tank. It's bankrupt. It was once the 11th largest economy in the world. Its unemployment rate is now over 20%. The state is hopelessly bankrupt because the state is stoned. So this is what happened. This idea was repeatedly rejected, and instead, in 1838, the government sentenced native drug traffickers to death. They rounded them up, and they hung them. They shot them. They did away with them. The same thing that we do. We round up the drug traffickers, and we put them in jail. We hunt them down with dogs, and we put them in jail. Around this time, the British were selling roughly, and this is going to stagger you, this is 1838, the British were selling roughly 1,400 tons per year to China. From 15 tons to 1,400 tons in roughly 70 years. British military superiority drew on newly applied technology, which, by the way, they paid for with the silver that they were getting from the drugs. British warships wreaked havoc on coastal towns. Why? Because they rounded up all their drug dealers and killed them. The steamship Nemesis was able to move against the winds and tides and support a gun platform with very heavy guns. In addition, the British troops were the first to be armed with modern muskets and cannons, which fired more rapidly and with greater accuracy than the Qing firearms, that's the Chinese firearms, and artillery, though Chinese cannons had been in use since previous dynasties. After the British took Canton, they sailed up the Yangtze and took the tax barges, a devastating blow to the empire, as it slashed the revenue of the imperial court in Beijing to just a fraction of what it had been. In 1842, just 4 years later, the Qing authorities sued for peace. The drug dealers had won. It concluded with the Treaty of Nanking, negotiated in August of that year and ratified in 1843. In the treaty, China was forced to pay an indemnity to Britain, open four ports to Britain, and cede Hong Kong to Queen Victoria. In the Supplementary Treaty of the Bogue, the Qing Empire also recognized Britain as an equal to China and gave British subjects extraterritorial privileges in treaty ports. In 1844, the United States and France concluded similar treaties with China, the Treaty of Wanghai and the Treaty of Whampoa, respectively. Now you know. You think it would be over. You think, okay, the drug dealers won. They brought in their warships because the Chinese rounded up all their drug dealers and killed them. So they came in and they gunned the place down and they stole the tax money of China. They broke them. And you'd think that'd be the end of it. But it wasn't. Because there was a second war that also lasted for 4 years. And it started in 1856. This is all before our Civil War, people. All before our Civil War even began. The Chinese authorities were reluctant to keep the terms of the 1842 Treaty of Nanking. They tried to keep out as many foreign merchants as possible and had victimized Chinese merchants who traded with the British at the treaty ports. To protect those Chinese merchants who were friendly to them at Hong Kong, the British granted their ships British registration in the hope that the Chinese authorities would not interfere with the vessels which carried the British flag. Well, that worked just so long. In October of 1856, the Chinese authorities in Canton seized a vessel called the Arrow, which had been engaged in piracy. The Arrow had formerly been registered as a British ship and was even still flying the British flag. Well, this is a big no-no. The British consul in Canton demanded the immediate release of the crew and an apology for the insult to the British flag. The crew were released, but an apology was not given. In reprisal, the British governor in Hong Kong ordered warships to bombard Canton. We have to teach these guys a lesson. The Second War over the pumping of opium into China had started. Negotiations between China, Britain, France, the USA, and Russia led to the Tianjin Treaties of June 26th to the 29th of 1858, which theoretically brought peace. Well, I have to tell you, usually treaties are just a written document that say, if you do this, we agree not to pound the stuffings out of you. And it's usually written by the guy with the bigger guns. That's what a treaty is. China agreed to open more treaty ports, to legalize opium importation, to establish a maritime customs service with foreign inspection, and to allow foreign legations at Peking and missionaries in the interior. Yes, not only are we going to deal drugs to you, but we're going to teach you about the Lord Jesus Christ. But as history has shown us time and time again, drug lords at the highest levels will never, ever agree to limit their trade. They again used their money and their power to bribe and corrupt the local government and the national government. So finally, China abrogated the Anglo-French treaties and refused to allow foreign diplomats into Peking. We have had enough. On June 25th, 1859, British Admiral Sir James Hope bombarded the forts guarding the mouth of the Hai River below Tianjin. However, landing parties were repulsed, and the British squadron was severely damaged by a surprisingly efficient Chinese garrison. Commodore Josiah Tutnall, commanding the U.S. Asiatic Squadron, declared blood is thicker than water and helped the British save face by assisting them in their withdrawal. They otherwise would have been wiped out to the last man. Anglo-French forces gathered at Hong Kong in May of 1860. A joint amphibious expedition moved north to the Gulf of Po Hai. It consisted of 11,000 British under General Sir James Hope Grant and 7,000 French under Lieutenant General Cousin Montauban. Unopposed landings were made at Pei Tang. The Taku forts were taken by assault with the assistance of the naval forces. We brought the army, folks. The British and the French armies attacked China to force them to take opium. The expedition then advanced upriver from Tianjin. As it approached Peking, the Chinese asked for talks and an armistice. An Allied delegation under Sir Harry Smith Parkes was sent to parley, but they were seized and imprisoned. Ooh, that's a violation of pirate law. It was later learned that half of them died under torture. The expedition pressed ahead, defeating some 30,000 Chinese in two engagements before reaching the walls of Peking on September 26th. Preparations for an assault commenced, and the old summer palace was occupied and looted. Now, we might as well have been talking about Russia and America, except that Afghanistan is not forcing their trade on anyone right now. I can tell you, many of you have never heard this story before. I can tell you that Afghani opium, they make 90% of the world's opium now. It's not made in India. India has progressed far beyond that. India is now a very, very progressive country. Yes, they still have areas where they don't have a lot of electricity or clean water, but they're getting there. India has most of the world's engineers now. You're going to find out as we cover this in the third hour tonight. They are educated, they are progressive, they are moral people who are heading for world dominance through technology and through a defensive posture. And they're not forcing their drugs on anyone. It's Afghanistan. Afghanistan, when we began operations there, as we financed the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda, that's why they were created in the first place, because they were enemies of the Russians. Why were they enemies of the Russians? Because the Russians had invaded Afghanistan with heavy mechanized units. And they went in there for one reason and one reason only. And that was to gain control of the opium fields, because there were huge, and I mean hundreds of billions of dollars worth of opium being grown in Afghanistan. Well, they occupied it easy enough. It's a pretty easy place to occupy. And then the ants come, two by two, and they terrorize, and they bomb, and they shoot down. And they use low-tech weaponry. They use sand in the oil, so to speak. Machines don't last long in the desert when the Afghanis, who are smiling and pretending to be your friends on one end, and they're destroying your machines on the other end, or they're addicting your troops to the very drug that they're trying to confiscate. That's what it's all about. When American troops first went in, you thought, well, okay, the first thing we got to do is destroy these fields. I'm going to play some clips for you in just a few minutes that are going to change your mind about that. I know I am not the only one who has put these pieces together, but I can tell you that this is well known by our military. If we wanted to end the heroin traffic, we could. We could do it in a few weeks. We used various nefarious agents in past wars to do this, as we have paid many millions to many parliamentary forces to do the same thing in lots of countries like Colombia and Mexico, Ecuador, and others to destroy the cocaine fields. It works. Temporarily, it works. But it also destroys the local economy if we don't replace it with something else. Now, you're going to hear something you have never heard before. Yeah, it was in the news, but you haven't put the pieces together like this. Ahmed Wali Karzai. Ever hear the name? He was a prominent politician in Afghanistan and the younger paternal half-brother of Afghan President Hamid Karzai. You know, the guy on TV with the weird hat. And the son of Abdul Ahad Karzai. As an elder of the Popalazai, the Popalazai Pashtun tribe, he was elected to the Kandahar Provincial Council in 2005 and served as its chairman. Karzai formerly lived in the U.S. city of, you got it, that was a good guess, the city of Chicago. Exactly right. 2005. 2 years before we ever heard the name Barack Obama. He worked in a restaurant owned by his family. He returned to Afghanistan following the removal of the Taliban government in late 2001, and he was shot and killed by one of his own bodyguards last July of 2011. Shot and killed by one of his own bodyguards. Because that's the way it is when you're a drug lord. As of June of 2009, the U.S. Embassy cable alleged that much of the actual business of running the Afghan city of Kandahar takes place out of public sight, where the infamous Ahmed Wali Karzai from Chicago operates, parallel to formal government structures through a network of political clans that use state institutions to protect and enable licit and illicit enterprises. We call this organized crime in this country. In addition, James Risen of the New York Times and others stated that Ahmed Wali Karzai may have been involved in the Afghan opium and heroin trade. Dun, dun, dun. This was denied by Karzai, who called the charges political propaganda and stated he was a victim of vicious politics, a terrible right-wing conspiracy. In meetings with Afghan President Hamid Karzai, including a 2006 session with former U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan Ronald E. Newman, the CIA's station chief and their British counterparts, American officials talked about the rumors in hopes that the president might move his brother out of the country, said several people who took part in or were briefed on the talks. We thought the concern expressed to Karzai might be enough to get him out of there, one official said. President Karzai resisted, however, demanding clear-cut evidence of wrongdoing. You have no proof. You have no evidence. We don't have that kind of hard, direct evidence that you could take to get a criminal indictment, a White House official said. All the witnesses, well, they're dead, or they won't talk. Ahmed Wali Karzai dismissed the allegations as politically motivated attacks by longtime rival groups in his country. Before the 2009 Afghan presidential election, which was 1 year after the 2008 presidential election in this country, Wali Karzai and Sher Mohammed Akhmudzadeh, former governor of the Helmand province and a member of the upper house of the Afghan parliament, were accused of vote rigging. After the election, reports mentioned that all those running in the election were involved in electoral fraud. Does this sound familiar? Holy cow! Come on, people. Hang on a second. course, this doesn't happen in this country. We know darn good and well that all those accusations that Democratic operatives forged ballot signatures and information in order to get Obama on the Indiana ballot to even run in the state as a presidential candidate are all false. They're all politically motivated, and there's no proof whatsoever. Even though the people testified in person on camera that that was not their signature, even though it's clear that without these signatures, Obama would never have been on the ballot in the state of Indiana to begin with. And without winning the state of Indiana, he probably would not have won the election because Hillary Clinton would have been on the ballot by herself as the Democratic primary candidate. Vote rigging, vote buying. Where did all this money come from to get a guy who nobody ever heard of before elected to the Senate in 2008? You don't do that overnight. You start planning that in, say, 2005, which happens to be when Wally Carzide was in Chicago running a restaurant. The same city that Wally Carzai was operating his restaurant is the same city in the same region that Mr. Barack Obama suddenly rose to notoriety with untold amounts of money. We still don't know where his money came from. Interesting stuff. Vote rigging, corruption, surprise. When Afghan security forces found an enormous cache of heroin hidden beneath concrete blocks in a tractor trailer outside Kandahar in 2004, the local Afghan commander quickly impounded the truck and notified his boss. Interesting stuff. What happened? What happened? Before long, the commander, Habibullah, it's a nice name, Habibi means friend. So Habibullah John received a telephone call from Ahmed Wali Karzai, the brother of President Hamid Karzai, asking him to release the vehicle and the drugs. Mr. John later told American investigators, according to notes from the debriefing obtained by the New York Times. He said he complied after getting a phone call from an aide to President Karzai, directing him to release the truck. So now we have not only the president's half-brother, paternal half-brother, but the president himself. He's now the president. You know, he's the guy with the hat and the cape that you see on TV. He's the guy that Barack Obama is talking to now. He's the guy that heads up the parliament in Afghanistan. That guy. 2 years later, American and Afghan counter-narcotics forces stopped another truck, this time near Kabul, finding more than 100 pounds of heroin. You know heroin, don't you? You've seen it. Smack. A tiny, tiny, this is a very toxic drug. It only takes a tiny, tiny amount. It is usually cut with all kinds of innocuous stuff, so that you can, you know, get it into your veins without overdosing. You get pure heroin, you're going to overdose. 110 pounds of heroin is an unbelievably powerful cache of the drug. And this is only one truck. Soon after the seizure, United States investigators told other American officials that they had discovered links between the drug shipment and a bodyguard believed to be an intermediary of Ahmed Wali Karzai, according to a participant in the briefing. The assertions about the involvement of the president's brother in the incidents were never investigated, according to American and Afghan officials, even though allegations that he has benefited from narcotics trafficking have circulated widely in Afghanistan. Sure, everybody knows Wali. Come on, my buddy Ahmed, of course, he turned me on to this. He got me started. I wouldn't have my organization. If it wasn't for my buddy Ahmed, well, we're fighting a war over this now, folks, so you better pay close attention. Both President Karzai and Ahmed Wali Karzai, now the chief of the Kandahar Provincial Council, the governing body for the region that includes Afghan's second largest city, dismissed the allegations as politically motivated attacks by longtime foes and infidels. I am not a drug dealer. I never was and I never will be, the president's brother said in a recent phone interview. I am a victim of a vicious right-wing conspiracy. I never had sex with that opium pipe. But the assertions about him have deeply worried top American officials in Kabul and in Washington. Not top enough, I'd say. The United States officials fear that perceptions that the Afghan president might be protecting his brother are damaging his credibility and undermining efforts by the United States to buttress his government, which has been under siege from rivals and a Taliban insurgency fueled by drug money, several senior Bush administration officials said. Well, that was then, and this is now. Wali has bit the bullet. He's gone. The bodyguard has now been promoted. Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, is now running the drug operation with impunity, and lest anybody know or figure out what's going on, they used copies of the Quran to, because they arrested a lot of these drug guys over there, to transfer messages out of the prison and out of the towns. So they just move Qurans around with the shipment schedules and with the drug orders in them. And, of course, investigators found this, gathered up the Qurans, and burned them. And they were summarily shot. Not because they were burning Qurans. Don't be stupid, people. They weren't burning Qurans. They were burning drug correspondence. All of the records were destroyed because they were being kept in Qurans. What appears to be a fairly common Afghan public perception of corruption inside their government is a tremendously corrosive element working against establishing long-term confidence in that government. A very serious matter. And that was Lieutenant General David W. Barno, who was the commander of coalition military forces in Afghanistan from 2003 to 2005, and he's now retired. He goes on to say, that could be problematic strategically for the United States. No kidding, David. No kidding. The White House says it believes that Ahmed Wali Karzai is involved in drug trafficking. The White House says, that's the Bush White House. And American officials have repeatedly warned President Karzai that his brother is a political liability. Listen, your brother, Wali, he's got to go, two senior Bush administration officials said in an interview last week. You got to take care of this guy. Send him on vacation for a while. You know, maybe Argentina, maybe the south of France, or maybe you could do something else with him. You know what I'm talking about? Don't not to move around here, but what a don't move to the union. You understand what I'm saying? Numerous reports link Ahmed Wali Karzai to the drug trade. Well, not anymore, because in July of last year, the guy assumed room temperature. Bush White House official said, that allows Karzai to say, where's your proof? Where's your proof? Neither the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, which conducts counter-narcotics efforts in Afghanistan, nor the fledgling Afghan Anti-Drug Agency, yeah, fledgling, I'm sure, has pursued investigations into the accusations against the president's brother. Several American investigators said senior officials at the DEA and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence complained to them that the White House favored a hands-off approach toward Ahmed Wali Karzai because of the political delicacy of the matter. Yeah, it's politically delicate, my friends. Very politically delicate. I'm going to play for you Hang on a second. I'm going to read this, and then I'm going to play it for you. it goes back a ways. You know, the Russians are not happy about this either. There was a Russian raid, and this is very recently, in Afghanistan. And the Russian raid was on none other than the opium trade, which was carried out with the participation of Afghan security forces. It's opened a fresh rift in Mr. Karzai's troubled alliance with Washington, which goes back to the year 2005. Not Bush, Obama, before he became a senator. Mr. Karzai said he had not been informed in advance of the operation, which took place on Thursday in eastern Nangarhar province, which borders Pakistan. While Afghanistan remains committed to its joint efforts with the international community against narcotics, I'm sure, it also makes it clear that no organization or institution shall have the right to carry out such a military operation without prior authorization and consent of the government of Afghanistan, Mr. Karzai's office said on Saturday. You got to let us know, guys, in advance when you're going to do a raid, right? Wink, wink. You understand? We got, you know, operations going on here. They're sensitive. We got Korans in the way here. We can't let anything get in the way. Mr. Karzai has frequently criticized the conduct of NATO forces in Afghanistan, particularly when they have caused civilian casualties. Just like in Mexico, drug lords will shield themselves behind primary children. They will shield their operations in a hospital or in a mosque. They will make sure and they will pay civilians to stand in front of these operations going on. Anything, any bullet, any explosion that goes off, you're going to kill civilians because they're right there next to them. Sensitivities over Russian involvement run high in the country, which was invaded by the Soviet Union in 1979. They know what the Russians are capable of doing. They know the Russians don't go by the Geneva Convention rulebook like we do. A U.S. official said Afghan's counter-narcotics police had conducted the operation with support from agents from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, NATO troops, and personnel from Russia's Federal Counter-Narcotics Force. You don't want to mess with those boys. Russian officials have said that four Russians, including two security officers and two intelligence officers, were involved in the first engagement by the Russian military in Afghanistan since Soviet forces withdrew after a disastrous 10-year war. Viktor Ivanov, the head of the Russian Federal Drugs Control Agency, told reporters in Moscow on Friday that the raid was a breakthrough that marked the first concrete example of cooperation between Russia and the U.S. to combat transnational drug trafficking networks. The Russians couldn't do it on their own after a 10-year war, and we are just now getting started into it. And I've got to tell you, these efforts are being hampered, and what I'm about to play you is going to drive you nuts. The Kremlin has repeatedly criticized NATO for failing to control heroin production in Afghanistan, which is fueling a surge in drug addiction in Russia and claiming thousands of lives each year. Production of opium, the raw material used to make heroin, has increased substantially in Afghanistan since the overthrow of the Taliban in 2001. Go figure. Afghanistan produces some 90% of the world's opium. I've already said that. Mr. Karzai agreed this week to extend a deadline to enforce the ban on let me back up just a little. Mr. Karzai had become embroiled in a public dispute with his allies over his plans to disband private security companies. You know, those are private security companies are like mercenaries. They're former soldiers, but now they work for pay. They're very smart, very fearless, and very tough. Washington fears Mr. Karzai's scheme could put U.S.-funded development projects worth hundreds of millions of dollars at risk. Now, I got to tell you that these development projects are hospitals, roads, schools, abilities to process minerals, which hopefully, because you realize that Afghanistan is a huge repository for lithium and other minerals, Afghanistan could easily transfer their gross national product from drugs to minerals. They could be a global powerhouse in rare earth metals. They're not interested. Mr. Karzai agreed this week to extend a deadline to enforce the ban. It's unclear whether he will bow to U.S. pressure to grant exemptions for companies protecting American private sector contractors carrying out aid work on behalf of Washington. These private contractors are bad dudes. They're former soldiers. A lot of them are former Navy SEALs. They're very tough. They have the best equipment because they're private. They're armed, they're armored, and they have access to satellite technology. And these guys are big and tough and mean, and they're not afraid. Development experts have frequently criticized U.S.-funded programs in Afghanistan, saying huge amounts of money have often been spent on protecting expatriate consultants working on schemes that have delivered scant benefits to Afghans. That's true. It doesn't. It is designed to educate them. It is designed to give them clean water. It is designed to give them access to health care. You might think that it's scant benefits to Afghans. No, it's not as good as a bundle of cash for looking the other way or for tilling an opium field or for smuggling drugs on the back of a donkey over a hill into Pakistan or into Russia. Yeah, it isn't that good, but it's better. Oh, I forgot to tell you one other thing about these private contractors. They absolutely, positively cannot be corrupted. You cannot torture them. You cannot bribe them. They are the most trustworthy individuals that we have in the field. They're professionals. If they weren't, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. Now, I can tell you what my theory is. What happens when judges keep letting the bad guys go? What happens when the district attorney won't prosecute the men who are the head of the criminal activities? The guys on the ground, the cops, the soldiers, the former soldiers who see the devastation that these drugs have on families, children, and the liberty of people, do something about it. When they do, they are killed, they are criticized, they are imprisoned, they're court-martialed, and they're targeted for annihilation. Our own U.S. military is being used to protect the opium crops. I'm not kidding. I'm going to play for you now a clip, the infamous Geraldo Rivera. This will play. It's a little old, but it's going to tell you exactly what's going on over there. You listen closely, because our troops, our full-time army troops, are being used to protect the opium
fields. The biggest obstacles in front of the U.S. troops there in Afghanistan is the opium trade. The Taliban is using it to intimidate the population.
Yeah. Joining us from Helmand Province is Geraldo Rivera. Good morning to you, Geraldo. Tell us what you've seen during your days there in Afghanistan.
Hi, Allison, Dave, and Clayton. Yes, in some ways, the Marines' brilliantly executed invasion of Marja, this town in the middle of Helmand province, was the easy part. The hard part now is governing this province, a province, as you suggest, that has become addicted to opium in many, many ways. That is the principal crop that is being grown here. The Taliban lend the farmers the money. They are indebted to the Taliban. They have to grow the opium. Now the Marines, in their success, are in a sense a victim of their success, because now the population is, they have these opium fields, and we are tolerating it. We are tolerating the cultivation of the opium, because we know that if we were to destroy it now, the population would turn against the Marines, and it would be a real security risk. Let me introduce Lieutenant Colonel Brian Christmas. He's the commanding officer of the 3rd Battalion, 6th Marines, really a wonderful group of Marines here. I know that you care deeply about this this contradiction, the fact that here you have one of the best fighting forces in the world ever mounted, and in a sense, you're watching as this opium is being grown. I know it grinds at your gut. How do you deal with it? What are you doing about it?
Well, frankly, this is a part of their culture. So while it might grind in my gut, it's what they do. We provide them security, we're providing them resources, and we're providing them alternatives. And the alternatives are different crops to grow. They're getting the seed and the fertilizer to do it. They can rotate any of their crops that they want. If they want to get rid of their wheat and grow cotton for the winter, they can do that, and we're going to help them do it. So the same thing goes for the cotton.
If we secure them having a good harvest, now they're going to get paid for all their hard work, and then we can deal with the trafficking afterwards.
And that is the new U.S. policy. After farmers get paid, try to capture drug traffickers. These troops have confiscated 10,000 pounds of opium before the profit reached the Taliban. One day, the U.S. hopes to convince farmers to choose legal crops. Until then, the seeds of the insurgency will continue to grow in these fields.
Okay, so now you know that story, that our own troops are being used to protect the fields. Now, make no mistake, when you look at the U.S. military make its moves in coming months, there's going to be a lot of pressure to get out of Afghanistan. It ain't going to happen. Make no mistake about the confidence the administration has about getting reelected. Cash coming in from drugs will make its way to PACs that will run ads that will influence the vote. And if that doesn't work, the company that counts the votes from American precincts has been bought by a foreign company owned by numerous VC groups. Those groups are led by Wall Street leaders that will seek to protect their interests. By the way, as we said a few weeks back on X Squared Radio, there is no audit trail with these new electronic tallies. The voting process cannot be traced. Once the results are transferred over the net, these secure election processes cannot be audited. In other words, you can't go back and say, wait a minute, we have videotape showing 412 people entering this voting precinct. Why do you have 1,450 votes cast from this precinct? It doesn't work. Because once this electronically gets transferred, once they report, it then goes overseas to Europe. A company called SCYTL, Skytel, has been sold. All of the vote tallying for the entire federal election is now owned by a foreign corporation that is run by Wall Street bankers. One can only wonder why, after all the elections and attempts to fix elections, have all the preparations been made for this time? What is so special about the national movements around the world that is different now than any time before? There's no threat of war. There's only a vague, fabricated threat of one Iranian nuclear weapon. Is that enough to start a war against a country of 55 million people that supplies the world with oil? Is there more at stake here than meets the eye? Do we have the whole story? Are you sure what is going to happen? Do you know the real reason why the folks down at Wars R Us are trying to sell the taxpayers on the idea that we must all tighten our belts and pull together to defeat the enemy? What enemy? Well, that's just it. Maybe the enemy hasn't arrived yet. One thing is for sure. When it comes to weaponry, if you build it, they will come. No weapon has ever been developed that has not been used as a demonstration at least once of power. Well, that is until now. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back after this message. Don't go away.
In armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun.
that was floating on the breeze. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. Yes, yes, glad you're here with us tonight. Coming to you live from east of the Appalachians, undisclosed location. Our AccuWindow forecast about 44 degrees tonight. Should be nice and sunny tomorrow. I am so glad that you are here with us today. That's what makes it worth coming out. I wanted to let you know, yes, 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 yes. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I want to let you know that Maya 2012 conference is coming up. Don't spend all that income tax refund money. Set aside some. Go to Maya 2012, the orange banner. Get your deposit in. Join me in Chichen Itza. You might as well be at ground zero when 2012 comes up, because this segment we're going to talk about some stuff that's going to occur in 2012 that's going to be interesting. we have to do this segment. I want to do it. It's so interesting, all this stuff about alien invasions, which it seems it's everywhere. I mean, it's everywhere. It's on the History Channel. It's on the news. It's in movies. It's becoming part of our culture. I'm not exactly sure why, but it is just pervasive. And I want to talk about it a little bit, get away from all the stuff about drugs and corruption, everything that's going on out there. Yes, yes, yes. I have a lot of messages coming in from various people around the world, and I appreciate them. I can't read them right now because I'm live on the air. If you're going to send me something, please send me something short that I can use, because I can't read and talk at the same time. I mean, I can drink grapefruit juice and talk at the same time, maybe, but that's about it. All right. This is a brand spanking new. I'm sure you may have heard it, but I'm going to talk about it right now. There are three giant alien spaceships that are again heading for Earth. Scientists predict the new ships will arrive in November of 2012. That could really harsh our gig in December of 2012, so I hope it's not true. But I got to cover this because it's just interesting stuff. UFO encounters continue to increase, as documented, everywhere. I mean, on the news, on the radio, you can't go to Google any day of the week and put in UFO encounters, but what you don't find, some kind of photo, some kind of footage. Every single day, every day, something happens up at James's Ranch. The ships are so pervasive now that they've just become friends up there. Amazing, amazing stuff. But it isn't all good news. Today, scientists at SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, an independent non-commercial organization, made a major announcement. This is going to amaze you because this isn't a fringe group. These are the main guys. This is L. Woods. This is the stuff Contact was written to address. I quote, three giant spaceships are headed toward Earth. The largest one of them is 200 miles wide. Two others are slightly smaller. At present, the objects are just moving past Jupiter. Judging by their speed, they should be on Earth by the fall of 2012, said John Malley, the lead extraterrestrial expert at SETI. I'm not making this up, okay? If you missed that, you need to go back and play this again. If you have friends that are not listening right now, call them up and tell them to listen to this live. I'm not making this up. This is true. Three similar giant spaceships landed in China and the Indonesia Sea in November of 2011. They were identified as alien spaceships from planet Gutan, whatever that means. Three more giant Gutan ships are headed here for November of 2012. This is really incredible stuff. I just watched a History Channel special on alien invasion. And I have to tell you, the production quality of this was superb. It was almost good enough to be a feature film in the theaters. The CG was a little corny because of the drones. But other than that, they were spot on. This was an hour-long special that was on History Channel today. And they didn't have any lightweights on here, okay? These were officials from the government. These were people with top-secret clearances that were on there. So I think that it was for real. And I think that they are really discussing, they're trying to prepare us for something. And if you believe that, or if you have any thoughts on that, you can give us a call, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. By the way, there's now an Android app at X Squared Radio. If you go there, click on the X Squared Radio little postage stamp thing there in the top. It will load an app to your Android phone. Now, the others, the Windows phone and the iPad, iPhone, iPod app is coming. I'm having a little bit of trouble with the Apple stuff, but I'm a smart guy. If it can be done, I'll figure it out. I'm going to improve this app soon so that you can listen to the program live. And if you want to call in, there'll be a button on the app itself. You just press it and it will call right into the theater or right into the studio. So you can join us live. You can jump right into the conversation live. So there's a little bit of a delay, but you can still get in there almost right on top of the conversation. This is happening as we speak, these preparations. And if you have any ideas or thoughts on this, I would really appreciate it. The new Gutan spaceships have been detected by HARP search system. The system based in Alaska was designed to study the phenomenon of northern lights. According to SETI researchers, the objects are extraterrestrial spaceships. They will be visible in optical telescopes as soon as they reach Mars's orbit. Sometime in November of 2012, the U.S. government has been reportedly informed about the event. SETI researchers have spent 50 years monitoring space. Dr. Malley said, they have conclusively proven that we are just newcomers in this huge and unexplored world. Many believe that there are many other civilizations in space besides our own civilization. WikiLeaks recently released many classified documents that prove that NASA and high-level U.S. officials are aware of the three spaceships and are making plans to battle the spaceships. My question is, do you think we need to battle them? do you think we need to get ready for an invasion? And what are we doing about the ones that landed in China and Indochina or in Indonesia? They have been concealing information from the U.S. public for decades. WikiLeaks also confirms that the UFO sightings over the last 3 months prove that the alien invasions have begun. Hang on one moment. I had to write somebody a quick note in India. That's writing in. Mali said that a Chinese official, Mao Khan, has obtained over more than 1,000 secret NASA photographs depicting not only human footprints but even a human carcass on the surface of the moon. I don't know about that. I do know that this week it was revealed that some 5,000 Chinese hacks of JPL in Pasadena were conducted. And not only was information lost, it was deleted from their hard drives. They accessed it, got it, and then deleted it, so we don't have it anymore. They also created their own user accounts, which means they kind of went in and created usernames and passwords so that they can get in. And this was not a small breach. It's been going on. 5,000 different events that have happened recently. This is an onslaught. Now, you think, oh, well, you know, people hack into JPL all the time because it's in Pasadena and people access the internet and blah, blah, blah. No. These were Chinese IP addresses. These weren't local. These weren't Southern California. These weren't Southern Indiana. These weren't Florida. These weren't, you know, New York. These came from China. People from China went into JPL, got access to highly sensitive information, and got out. And we're trying to find the IP addresses in China, and I can promise you right now that it's been triple, quadruple pinged, and they're going to be gone. If you ever go overseas, especially to Asia, the one thing that you'll see very common are internet bars. Lots of people over there can't really afford computers, but they still love to game. So what they do is they go into internet bars, which are set up with rows and rows and rows of computers. And you can sit down with your controller or your mouse and your headset, and you can talk or you can game with people all over the world. I've been in them because I go overseas, and sometimes I don't take my laptop because, while you're out and about in the countryside, people go in your hotel room and they access your laptop. And I didn't want that to happen, so I didn't take my laptop. So I still had to communicate with people here back in the States, so I go to an internet bar and use something like Yahoo or Gmail or something like that to communicate, not my own, you know, website. So they can't really find it, and there are ways of communicating back and forth. You just email yourself and your own account, and both of you log into the same email account, so the email never actually leaves the account. It just goes into the sent file and the received file, and so the two of you can communicate back and forth without actually really sending an email. There are lots of ways to do this. But the important part is that the IP addresses are all anonymous. You could make all of these hacks by going into the router at these internet bars, and you never leave a trail. So they're never going to find these guys. But the truth is that all of this information, high top-level security clearance information, has been hacked into at JPL by Chinese hackers. So when they say that they have this information and they've let it out, what they have wanted to let out, it is probably true. Now, the question is all this fake? I mean, do the government really know something that they're not sharing? Are the alarmists correct that the threat would first show up as a near pass as an asteroid and then a close threat of a collision? Would they be able to marshal and unite a $6 trillion global defense budget? That's what we spend globally on national defense, because everybody's nationally defending themselves against everybody else. So if we all said, well, okay, let's, like Reagan said, let's stop defending ourselves against each other and let's defend ourselves against somebody out there, maybe this could come through. I'll play a little clip for you right here just to try to – let's see if I can get my mouse to work here. Okay, here we go. I'll play the clip and then we'll talk about it. Here we go. It's coming up.
A former Canadian government official is warning we may be on the verge of intergalactic war, saying, quote, the Bush administration has finally agreed to let the military build a forward base on the moon, which will put them in a better position to keep track of the comings and goings of visitors from space and to shoot at them if they so decide.
I was introduced to the late Dr. Wernher von Braun in the U.S., the father of rocketry. In my first meeting with him during that first 3.5 hours, he said to me, Carol, you will stop the weaponization of space because there is a lie being told to everyone that the weaponization of space is now first being based upon the evil empire, the Russians. There are many enemies, he said, against whom we're going to build this space-based weapon system, the first of whom was the Russians, which was existing at that time. Then there would be terrorists. Then there would be third world countries. Now we call them rogue nations or nations of concern. Then there would be asteroids. And then he would repeat to me over and over, and the last card, the last card, the last card would be the extraterrestrial threat.
Pardon me, I don't mean to interrupt you, but doesn't this make sense? I mean, if in fact there are extraterrestrials and they're buzzing our planet, why wouldn't we want to take steps to defend ourselves from them should they turn hostile?
As a military strategist, as a person who worked on the MX missile, which I did later, he said, you will find that there is going to be a spin to find some enemy against whom we have to build space-based weapons. And now we should expect the spin, because he said part of the formula for the intelligence community is if they might have a weapon, then we have to consider that they do have these weapons. So now they do have these weapons. So now we have to build these weapon systems. And that's the formula, except that it's all based on a lie.
This is a report into future technology, commissioned in 1968 by McDonnell Douglas, then one of the biggest aerospace and defense contractors in the world. What's extraordinary about this document is that it takes the existence of UFOs seriously. It recommends using UFOs and copying their design to make the next quantum leap in aerospace technology.
Some UFOs may be extraterrestrial vehicles. They certainly have not been proven otherwise. The existence of extraterrestrial vehicles indicates vehicles could be built which would have capabilities quite useful to McDonnell Douglas Corporation.
A supersonic saucer. Called the Silver Bug, it was truly revolutionary. The plans show in detail a multi-jet engine craft that boasted amazing maneuverability and speed. It's an intriguing thought that this concept may tie in with the work of the German scientists who brought saucer technology to the US at the close of the Second World War. I believe Silverbug could explain what Lonnie Zamora witnessed in the New Mexico desert in April 1964. His description of a silver disc-shaped object appears to fit in with the Silverbug profile.
Was needed were certain cover stories. What do you do when people are spotting aircraft and then telling reporters that they've seen something very unusual flying out of an airbase in Nevada? And frankly, this was the origin of a lot of the sightings that took place in the mid-50s, 1954, 55, 56, of unidentified flying objects, the UFOs. So the CIA was involved in encouraging people to believe that, yes, they saw UFOs, and the CIA and the military tried to be very helpful to reporters to get these stories out, to divert the attention of the country, and particularly the people in this region, about what they had actually seen.
Well, that is, it'll be a quick break here while they play some text here, and I don't have it, so I'm not going to read it to you. But the idea is all of this fake? Have we been duped? Is this a false flag event? Are there really aliens coming? Do we have to prepare ourselves to do battle against them? I can say from my own historical research that normally human societies, as they become more intelligent, they become more predatory. It's the prey that has to be outsmarted in order for the predator to survive. Obviously, if the prey is too smart, then the predator will starve to death. So we can assume, just based on the millions and millions of species that are here on this planet, that it is the predator that displays the superior intelligence, always has been. Is that the way it is in space? Would an organization that traveled a long way across space, entered a solar system, took months and months and months to travel from Jupiter to Earth without, there's no reinforcements. I mean, you come here and get your butt kicked, it's over for you. There's no communication back home. It'd take a long, long time for a communication to get back to Earth. You know, Mebs, danger, Earth defenses, turn around, go back. You know, that kind of stuff. It has to be practical. If you're going to go from planet to planet and do this, you have to make sure that you can beat them. And, if they're looking at our historical records, movies, I'm sure they're convinced that our weaponry is quite advanced. On the other hand, it's the low-tech weapons that seem to have the most effect, unless you completely eradicate the locals, a la Afghanistan. Russians have been in there for 10 years. They went home with their tail between their legs. We've been in there for over 10 years. We're going to go home with our tail between our legs. Why? Because, you know, sand in the bearings, folks. It's just low-tech weaponry. They just pest you to death, and you cannot trust anybody. Anybody. They're all against you eventually. Why? Because you're the alien. Let's see what else we have here. Okay, we got a little bit more audio coming to you on this clip. And it's, I don't know.
Mexican Air Force pilots capturing on videotape what are said to be 11, count them, 11 UFOs.
The Mexican Air Force has released a video that some of you are going to find difficult to believe. A journalist says it shows images of UFOs tracking a Mexican military plane.
So what's the truth about UFOs? The story of successive attempts to develop radically new forms of flight, conducted under the strictest secrecy, is inextricably bound up with our relationship with UFOs over the last 60 years. Whether it's Allied pilots buzzed by strange balls of fire in 1942, or the Roswell incident 5 years later, there is a strong case to be made that secret military technology offers a convincing explanation for many UFO stories. For me, what is so striking about Roswell is that it's the first good example of an officially sanctioned UFO disinformation exercise. It showed the CIA that UFOs could provide perfect cover for their Cold War activities. It didn't take much for the CIA to spin the extraterrestrial story into the hearts and minds of the American public. And once it was there, all manner of experimental technology could, if it was spotted, be put down to the UFO phenomenon. But there are some cases that I just can't explain. The sightings of UFOs over Capitol Hill in 1952 are still baffling. What is certain is that real-world UFOs, the man-made ones, continue to develop. Recently, a series of sonic booms were heard exploding across California and Nevada. Something was in the sky that could be heard and felt, but not seen. Some informed observers, and I'm one of them, believe it was an aircraft traveling at several thousand miles per hour. A secret project known as Aurora.
There is no trace of Aurora's physical existence, no evidence of government spending on its development or deployment. But there are tantalizing images that point to its existence. Pictures, for example, like this one. It shows a donut-shaped exhaust pattern, a sign perhaps that Aurora makes use of something called a pulse detonation wave engine. And it delivers a hell of a punch, easily enough power to drive an aircraft to 6 times the speed of sound. But perhaps the most intriguing are these images. This is a weather satellite image that shows a very interesting contrail originating out of Area 51 in Nevada and moving all the way across the United States, out over the Atlantic, on across Europe, and into Russia and China. Whatever it is, it's moving in excess of 8,000 miles an hour. If it is the contrail of a high-altitude hypersonic aircraft, in my book, it's the best evidence yet that Aurora is real.
Anytime the government has secrets that they can keep from us, they can manipulate us by those secrets. In essence, they still remain 25 years at least ahead of us in technology, information, and knowledge, and secrets, and they are using them against us. I heard over the years many times over that the plan to usher in the new world order would be to make all the people in this country and around the world feel totally helpless to prevent the new world order from occurring, this world dominance plan, by saying that we had been invaded by aliens, so that we would say, oh please, UN, come in and help us all. So bear in mind that there is a plan, orchestration, to get people to be submissive through the secret technology and information that they're keeping from you under the blanket of the so-called National Security Act that's threatening the security of our nation.
You're being programmed since the second you're born in front of a television set, movies and everything else to get totally different. So all you're doing is being programmed to stay in the physical dimension. I mean, the final conflict that these guys have is set up in motion. When we get through reducing the world's population, then they're going to have this organized group. I mean, the New World Order is the socialist dictatorship.
Okay. That's all I want to get into. It started out a pretty good piece, but it starts to get all into that conspiracy theory stuff. And I don't know, it just loses credibility for me. I just wanted to make the point. Are they real? Would they even be invaders? You know, our anthropologists and historians say that superior intelligence develops not in the prey, but in the predator. It must be able to outsmart its victims at little or no loss. Going back across the galaxy for reinforcements is obviously not an option. You are the advanced force that must win or be remitted to the cold blackness of space. And yet, we are intelligent and have never put a weapon on board a spacecraft. Or have we? Interesting stuff. Are we the only ones talking about this, though? No, we are not. Russian scientists predict alien encounters on Earth by January 8th, 2012. I got news for you. It's March 4th, 2012. Let's see how credible the Russians are. Russian scientists released a report yesterday that said they expect humans to encounter aliens on Earth by the beginning of 2012. Really? Have you seen an alien lately? Maybe you have. Listen more. The genesis of life is as inevitable as the formations of atoms. Alien life exists on other planets, and it exists on our planes, said Andrei Yanstein, director of the Russian Academy of Sciences Applied Astronomy Institute, according to the Interfax News Agency. We have developed a technology that will allow humans to identify the aliens among us. Uh-oh, said Yanstein. He would not elaborate on the technology that allows to do this, but he did say that the Russians were way out ahead of the Americans on this one. I'm not going to Russia anytime soon. Yanstein said that aliens have different color skin, which may be transparent at times. He explained that aliens have been increasing in numbers over the last 15 months. This correlates to the ongoing alien invasion, said Professor John Malley of the UN panel on extraterrestrials. Aliens have been invading our planet since February of 2009, with an increased number in October of 2010, and now the full invasion is underway. Humans must prepare. The UN said that it will be coordinating plans for dealing with extraterrestrials, and at this point they cannot guarantee that they will be friendly. It all depends on how humans react to them. If we are kind and welcoming, we can coexist. If we are afraid and start attacking, there will be an all-out alien war, and we will lose, said Malley. Janstein went on to say that 10% of the known planets circling suns in the galaxy resemble Earth, and most of them have life forms similar to humans. If water can be found there, then so can life, he said, adding that aliens would most likely resemble humans with two arms and two legs and a head. Richard Coolidge, an astrobiologist at the U.S. Space Agency's Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama, agreed with the findings of the Russian report. Aliens are here, and they are making themselves known, said Coolidge. Asked how the Russians came up with the January 8th date, Janstein replied, "We spent several years analyzing the data, and that is the farthest point possible for the aliens to reveal themselves without being noticed by the naked human eye." Writing in the Journal of Cosmology, Hoover claimed that the lack of nitrogen in the samples, which is essential for life on Earth, indicated they are the remains of extraterrestrial life forms that grew on the parent bodies of the meteorites when liquid water was present, long before the meteorites entered the Earth's atmosphere. Get ready for your close encounter. Richard Coolidge, an astrobiologist. Oh, hang on a second. I just copied that. All right. So we're good. We're good. Now, American advanced education. This is what I wanted to cover in the final hour. We have about 7 or 8 minutes, and I want to cover this. The U.S. Department of Education has an annual budget of more than $1 billion. I bet you didn't know that. It also does not educate a single person. I bet you didn't know that either. The state of North Carolina ranks in the top of its class in secondary education. However, K through 12, it ranks 37th. Kentucky ranks better than North Carolina. Why? What is the system that makes education function? And most people say that this starts at home, and I would agree. But it matters where home is, I suppose. I want you to listen to my colleague, Dr. Michio Kaku, speaking on a panel on collegiate performance. I think you're going to find this interesting. And then I'm going to add my words at the end of it. Hang on, it's very short.
I must disagree with my esteemed colleague here. Okay. Except first of all, let me say that science is the engine of prosperity. From steam power to electricity to the laser to the transistor to the computer.
That's not true.
We're talking
technology.
About. Hey, mate. Hey, can I have my.
Sure.
You had your say. Let me have my say.
Yes.
However, the information revolution has a weakness, and the weakness is precisely the educational system. The United States has the worst educational system known to science. Our graduates compete regularly at the level of third world countries. So how come the scientific establishment of the United States doesn't collapse? If we're producing a generation of dummies, if the stupid index of America keeps rising every year, just watch network television and reality shows, right? How come the scientific establishment of the United States doesn't collapse? Let me tell you something. Some of you may not know this. America has a secret weapon. That secret weapon is the H-1B. Without the H-1B, the scientific establishment of this country would collapse. Forget about Google. Forget about Silicon Valley. There would be no Silicon Valley without the H-1B. And you know what the H-1B is? It's the genius visa, okay? You realize that in the United States, 50% of all PhD candidates are foreign-born. At my system, one of the biggest in the United States, 100% of the PhD candidates are foreign-born. The United States is a magnet sucking up all the brains of the world, but Now the brains are going back. They're going back to China. They're going back to India. And people are saying, oh my God, there's a Silicon Valley in India now. Oh my God, there's a Silicon Valley in China. Duh. Where did it come from? It came from the United States. So don't tell me that science isn't the engine of prosperity. You remove the H-1B visa and you collapse the economy. In Wall Street Journal, editorialized against a congressman who wanted to ban the H-1B, saying they'll take jobs away from the American people. The Wall Street Journal said, look, there are no Americans who can take these jobs. These are at the highest level of high technology. They don't take away jobs from Americans. They create entire industries. And so that's why we have an Achilles heel, and that's the educational system. Sociology majors are not necessarily going to be the ones determining the future of Silicon Valley. But physicists, engineers, we need more of them, not less.
The irony is... The irony is, I agree with the immigration issues, what you're saying. And I'm at a school, of course, and Peter's a graduate of a school where indeed immigration.
Your school wouldn't exist without the H-1B.
Of course. But I'm not.
We've got to get back to the future of business.
But hold on a second. No. I'm not arguing against an H-1B. I completely agree with this issue. And the point on the future of business that he's making, which is very, very important, is the nature of human capital. What is misunderstood here is, again, how poorly run schools are. MIT is a notable exception in this regard. His school is not, because what happens is they run in these introductory science and engineering classes at Illinois and Wisconsin and Michigan. They run freshman and sophomore years as flunk out operations. They run it as a boot camp, and then people are surprised that people don't take science, that they don't take the STEM courses.
He is exactly right. They run the freshman and sophomore courses like a boot camp. I am an honor graduate in nuclear chemistry. I was alone as an American in my graduating class. I was the only American on the honor roll in the entire College of Chemistry. The rest were Chinese, Japanese, and Indian. Oh, and by the way, the Chinese students had to record and translate all the lectures into Chinese each night just to keep up. And they still did it. And they got high grades. When I was working in the lab until late at night and on weekends to excel, there were no Americans in the lab, only Chinese. I want you to take a good look at where we are going, what we are doing here. College enrollment is all about the money. A foreign student here on the H-1B visa has to pay 3 to 4 times the tuition I had to pay as an in-state resident. Classes were not geared for us. They were geared for outside students who came in under government orders to learn or go back to the mines or to the farms from which they come. They are going to do whatever it takes to make the grade. My best math and science instructors were not American. They were Indian. That's what I'm trying to explain to you. We are a nation that is dedicated to our iPhones, we're dedicated to getting high, we're dedicated to having fun, to what's on TV, and we don't care about anything. We don't care about our country, we don't care about voting, we don't care about who is in the White House. I can tell you that we are duped every day when we turn the TV on and we hear those people talking.
I know who I am. I'm a dude playing a dude disguised as another dude.
That's exactly right. They're a dude playing a dude disguised as another dude. That's exactly what we have leading our country. I can tell you I'm passionate about it. I know you are too. That's why you're tuned in every single week right here on X Squared Radio. And the programs are going to get better and better because we're going to get very, very passionate about this political process from a scientific point of view. I'm not going to tell you who to vote for. I am going to keep you informed so you can make up your own mind. And am I going to slant my content? You bet I am. I'm going to slant it toward the Constitution because that is the form of government that works. We have to return to a representative government. We have a government that is operating right now completely unrepresentative of the American people. Thousands upon thousands of regulations are being written every year without representation. They are taxing you. They are charging you fees. They are making you spend money to comply with these regulations, and you have no representation. Congress is not involved in the process whatsoever. No local government, no state government, no federal government involvement at all with an elected official. Not until you complain about the regulation. And it takes not one of you, but thousands of you. Last week, we witnessed on the radio, on the television, the stupidest waste of time I have ever seen in politics. Some law school student was up there complaining that she was going to have to go through law school while paying for her own birth control. Now, although I think that's an important topic, why in the world were we wasting our time on it? Not only were we wasting valuable time in a congressional committee, we were wasting time on the news about it. Because there are 100,000 small businesses out there that are starving to death because they have to jump through hoops and they have to order all kinds of new equipment and they have to scrap old plans to comply with erroneous, silly regulations that are set up by one various organization or another. Between the EPA, the NHTSA, and a variety of other alphabet soup organizations there in Washington, small business has come to an absolute grinding halt in the United States of America. And we're arguing over birth control. Will you please write your congressman? Will you please write your local news station and say, get a grip, be real. But in the sense that you can't be, you can tune in right here to X Squared Radio, and I promise you, I will keep you straight. We're going to go places, you and me, together. And I'll see you here next week right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.